Southeast Oklahoma is an unusual place, politically speaking. I'm headed to McAllister, the honorary capital of what was once known as Little Dixie, because of the large number of Southerners who came to start new lives here after the Civil War. But in the second half of the 20th century, Little Dixie came to be the Democratic Party-dominated center of political power in Oklahoma. Even in the late 1990s, decades after most of the rest of the South went to the Republican Party, Democrats enjoyed an 8-to-1 voter registration advantage here. Despite the backlash against the Democrats over civil rights in the 1960s, despite the Reagan Revolution and the ensuing culture wars, a Republican trying to run for local office in Little Dixie was utterly wasting his time and money. But over the past decade, that Democratic dominance has completely collapsed. The question isn't really why this part of Oklahoma turned away from the Democratic Party, but why it took so long. Over the next hour, I'll try to answer that question, and this is a good place to start, at the corner of 2nd and Adams in McAllister. To my left, a 2.5-ton lump of coal outside the old McAllister High School building. To my right, one of the biggest and most elaborate Masonic lodges in the country. These monuments tell a story that will help me find the answers I seek. But let's start at the beginning.
To really understand the politics of southeastern Oklahoma, you have to go back to removal, because the roots of politics in eastern Oklahoma are the same as the roots of the Indian tribes.
That's Bob Blackburn, executive director of the Oklahoma Historical Society. There's no higher authority on the state's history.
And so when the Indian tribes are moved out of the southeast, they bring with them very much a southern culture. The mixed bloods who are generally running the tribal affairs, John Ross, for example, was 1/8 Cherokee. But southern through and through, the richest Choctaw, Robert M. Jones, a delegate to the Confederate Congress during the Civil War, was half Choctaw, half Scots. And so the mixed blood leaders were all southerners. They were tied in with the southern economy. Generally, when they thought of connections to the outside world, they thought south. And so you have the southern culture.
Remember, all five major tribes side with the South in the Civil War. Their ties to the South would help shape Oklahoma's view of the federal government through statehood and beyond.
So spinning out of the Civil War, the mythology, along with a little bit of the reality, is that the Republicans, Abraham Lincoln, invaded the South, and the lost cause was trying to save the purity of the Constitution, states' rights, their ability to leave the Union, that without the Republicans and without Abraham Lincoln, they would have had their own nation.
So the Republicans were the enemy in the eyes of the people in what would become Oklahoma during and just after the Civil War, and Republicans ran the federal government. And this idea of the lost cause of the Confederacy was shared between the Indian people in the territory and the wider South, which was loyal to the Democratic Party at the time.
Well, this general assault on tribal sovereignty that starts in 1866 with a Republican-controlled Congress, the Radical Republicans, is to force the tribes to allow the first railroads through, which brings the first non-Indian cities, taking away their western lands for other tribes, setting up the state-making process. And the roots of allotment and severalty and getting rid of communally owned land starts in 1866. Which accelerates in 1887 with the General Allotment Act, again, Republican-based reform.
Basically, the Republicans abolished the tribal nations and reservations and converted what was communal land to individual property. It didn't go over well in Indian Territory or in the rest of the South.
And as one Republican senator said at the time, we really need the concept of selfishness so they will progress. And if they're selfish and they want to have more money and more property, then they'll become good little Americans and culture will progress. Well, that was an assault on the agrarian South as much as it was a political philosophy and an assault on Indian sovereignty. Because the idea of the agrarian community is everyone's a self-subsistence farmer, we're part of this bigger community. And then by sharing and helping each other, you know, that's the agrarian Jeffersonian myth. That's part of the democratic political culture at the same time. So,
fast forward to the lead-up to statehood in 1907. Indian Territory, eastern Oklahoma, petitions to be its own state, called Sequoia, and is denied, in part because Sequoia would be a solidly democratic state. Keith Gaddy, political science department chair at the University of Oklahoma.
This is a period of tremendous oscillation in American legislative politics. From the 1870s until 1920, the Republicans generally dominate presidential politics. Okay, the Democrats are going to elect two presidents in a 60-year period.
Wow.
But Congress swings back and forth in terms of control. The U.S. Senate swings back and forth in terms of control. And Republicans don't want to give any upper hand to the Democrats by giving them a new state. So you take Sequoia, the proposed state of Sequoia, you merge it with Oklahoma Territory and with Cimarron, right? And that gives you modern Oklahoma. And it's admitted as a state that's supposed to have more partisan balance to it.
Oklahoma Territory and Cimarron, western Oklahoma and the Panhandle. These parts of Oklahoma were settled by Midwesterners, Northerners, in another word, Republicans. But there was to be no political balance in Oklahoma.
Now, you go north and west, the settlers are coming from Kansas, right? They're coming from the Midwest. You have folks who might have failed in farming in Missouri and in Minnesota and in the Dakotas, and now they've come down here. And Oklahoma, in many ways, Oklahoma Territory is the land of second chances, that western part of the state, the land of second chances. You come here and you start over. And that period from the late 1880s until the 1920s is an unusual period in terms of the climate of this area. It was an unusually wet period. The soil was unusually fertile. And these counties fill up with people that are settling in quarter section and half section land grants, right? But these folks also bring Republican politics. They're coming from the Republican parts of the country. But the fact is there just aren't enough Republican bodies in the state, in the western part of the state, to counterbalance the Democratic-leaning environments of Oklahoma City and Guthrie and Norman, and the overwhelmingly Democratic southeastern part of the state.
The relatively thin population in western Oklahoma would thin further once that fertile farmland dried up and blew away during the Dust Bowl. The negative attitude toward Republicans brought on by the trickle-down effect of the Civil War, the complicated politicking that made today's Oklahoma, as opposed to two or three different states, and the demographic consequences of that decision, are just a few of the reasons southeast Oklahoma became so loyal to the Democratic Party in the late 19th and early 20th century. Which brings me to that giant lump of coal on 2nd Street in McAllister, Bob Blackburn.
Coal actually pops out of the earth in those areas and was very inexpensive to mine it. Of course, as they took the surface coal, then they had to go down. They followed these veins down with the deep shaft mines. Well, to work the mines, the Indians weren't going to go down into those mines. They had more sense than that. So they start bringing in immigrants from Wales, from Italy.
So if you just do the spaghetti dinner, that's what you're getting instead of an extra entree. Or you can do like the sausage or something like that.
Just outside McAllister, in Krebs, the influence of Italian immigration is impossible to miss. Driving into town, there's a sign that touts Krebs as Oklahoma's Little Italy, and it lives up to the name. It's a town of 2,000 people, and there are three iconic and independent Italian restaurants run by families who have been here since the coal mining days. I'm in one of them, Pete's Place, where chalk beer used to be sold out back illegally during the Prohibition years.
I will have the lamb fries.
Try ordering testicles at Olive Garden.
This is where we bring all the cheese. We make an Ada and all the cheese here. Can't actually go in here without like a smock and hairnet on, but you can get a whiff of that.
Wow.
Just a few hundred yards away is Lavera's Italian Store, legendary for its Italian sausage and Caciocavallo cheese, both of which are made right here. 17-year-old Matteo Lavera shows me around.
This is our cave-age Caciocavallo right here. And then these wheels that you see here are the Oklahoma Toma.
Pasta everywhere, all varieties of fresh meats and cheeses. It's hard to believe I'm in Oklahoma. Sammy Lavera owns the place and tells me his grandparents, Martin and Batista Lavera, came to Oklahoma in 1907 from the Italian Alps.
My grandparents were just real adventurous young people. They're in their early, mid-20s, didn't have any kids. And they wanted a better life, so they came. And there were a few people came over here before them, and they worked and they made some money, and they went back. They brought it back. So I met one of these old guys when I was over there in '79. One of my cousins took me up in the mountain. We were walking up the mountains, and they said, this old guy is about 95 years old. People live like in the 90s up in the, yeah. I guess they walk up and down those mountains, and it's good for them.
Eat good food.
Great food, yeah. Great water.
Yeah.
And this old man, he said he'd been in Krebs and he brought back a bunch. He brought back gold because they used to pay these miners, I think, in gold in the early, late 1890s and early 1900s.
Times were hard for the people of Little Dixie and the Laveras in the early 20th century, to put it very mildly.
See, they had 4 kids, and then the second one's name was Giovanni. He got scalded. They were boiling water or something for either making chalk or cooking. Washing clothes. I don't know. Anyway, he fell. Him and Sam were, they were like 4 and 5 years old, and he got scalded. He died about 5 days later. That must have been an agonizing death, especially for my grandmother to see that. And then my Aunt Mary had a twin. They were, and he was a hemophiliac, and he lived to about, I guess he must have been 10 or 12, and he died because he bled to death. No medical care, much at all, you know. Yeah. And then my dad came along. So actually the only two survived children were my Aunt Mary and my dad.
Sammy Lavera's grandfather never wanted to work in the coal mines, but was forced to when the Great Depression hit, and mining was about the only job around. His son Sam did the same.
And he only worked like 2 months and exploded one night and killed them both. And I don't know why they put him on the same shift, but there was about 100 people killed in that coal mine.
Let's go back to Bob Blackburn for some perspective on how all of this, coal mining, poverty, European immigration, relates to politics in southeast Oklahoma.
Why would you take a job going down to a mine that's that dangerous? Well, because you have no other choice, generally. So that was a way they could support their family. So here you bring in this European culture that has its roots in medieval culture of the guilds, of unionization, of radical politics. You throw that mixture in, and you get enough of those unionized industries. The railroads are largely in eastern Oklahoma. The coal mines are largely in eastern Oklahoma. And those industries had been unionized coming out of the 19th century. So you get that political culture embedded along with all these other political cultures, the Scots-Irish, the assault on American Indians, the dispossessed rural population that no longer can make it. And all of them think that the banks and the railroads and big business and centralized government are the enemy.
Guilds, Scots-Irish culture. So answers the question of why McAllister has such a big, elaborate Masonic lodge. It's also becoming clearer why southeast Oklahoma became so democratic in the first place.
What John Steinbeck wrote about was really the Jode family as a Little Dixie family that no longer can make it as a sharecropping family. So where do you go? Well, they went to California. A lot of them went to Oklahoma City or Dallas or Tulsa or Wichita, where they could find these jobs in urban areas.
Urban, at the time, meaning more Republican.
But it largely leaves the southeastern part of the state out of that change. And so the old democratic, conservative, populist, tribal sovereignty, Indian culture, Scots-Irish blended in there, survives without all of these other changes that are affecting Tulsa County and Oklahoma County and a large part of western Oklahoma.
So southeast Oklahoma was poor and jobless. Those left behind needed a hero, and they got one.
It is preeminently the time to speak the truth frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive, and will prosper.
Franklin Roosevelt. His impact would be felt in Little Dixie's politics for the next 70 years. The first question this documentary set out to answer was why southeast Oklahoma came to be so loyal to the Democratic Party in the first place. Franklin Roosevelt was the most common answer, from Bob Blackburn.
Well, my grandmother thought Franklin D. Roosevelt was her hero of all time and basically brought electricity to the rural community and really cared about the common man.
From Sammy Lavera.
Why the area became so loyal to the Democratic Party in the first
Roosevelt,
place.
Right?
From POTO politician Kenneth Korn, who we'll hear more from later in the hour.
I did my senior thesis on Franklin Roosevelt and his impact in southeast Oklahoma. At that time, you still had a lot of people who remembered Franklin Roosevelt, and they would tell you, Franklin Roosevelt saved this country and saved their families and put their mom and dad to work and got us, led us to the war. And those people remembered that, and they remembered he was a Democrat. They remember what happened when Hoover, who came up with these disastrous policies, they remember what happened to their families, and they remember who pulled them out.
The dispossessed rural population, as Bob Blackburn puts it, took to the New Deal far more positively than the rest of the state.
And so they band together, and under the banner of the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt, they become staunch Democrats again. So that's compounded in the 1930s. And out of that New Deal culture of more government involvement, which is kind of ironic with this fear of centralized government, but yet suddenly they're bringing in the grants, creating jobs, building highways. And so the coalition that Franklin Roosevelt put together in the 30s was this dispossessed white population, giving hope to the African-American population, reaching out to the Indian population with the Indian New Deal. When he brought Collier in as secretary or the to lead the Bureau of Indian Affairs, as we would call it today, they were reaching out trying to give authority and sovereignty back to the Indian tribes. This was all part of the New Deal.
The Oklahoma Historical Society's Encyclopedia of Oklahoma History details how the state resisted the New Deal in general. Alfalfa Bill Murray was the governor at the time, and he was a bizarre character, known for his creative use of the Oklahoma National Guard against Texas and dishonest oil barons. He's worthy of his own separate documentary, but what's important for our purposes is he hated Franklin Roosevelt, even running against him for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1932. But Keith Gaddy says in Little Dixie, Roosevelt's message got through.
You know, that Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, they're living memories. It's more than water. It's Social Security. You know, it's unemployment insurance. It is also the fact that there were old people that lived down there at a time where less than half of Little Dixie had radios in the households. And you'd go up to a crossroads to one of those little white ash pot painted grocery stores that you find down there, right? Mm-hmm. And you'd listen to Roosevelt on the radio, or you'd get the war news. And for all these veterans who came back, where Roosevelt was their president, and that stuck in their mind that government could be a force for good and could do great things. And they felt that way at the presidential level until the Great Society. If LBJ had stopped electrification, the South would still be Democratic.
If President Johnson had stopped with electrification, the South would still be Democratic. But he didn't. He pushed for civil rights legislation and signed the Civil Rights Bill of 1964 that outlawed discrimination based on, among other things, race.
Let us lay aside irrelevant differences and make our nation whole. Let us hasten that day when our unmeasured strength and our unbounded spirit will be free to do the great works ordained for this nation by the just and wise God, who is the Father of us all. Thank you and good night.
That was the statement made by President Johnson at the signing ceremony for the bill. He's said to have commented afterward that the Democrats had lost the South for a generation. And it was true for Oklahoma, too.
This became a Republican state for president in 1968. Okay, the Democrats have not won the electoral votes of this state in 50 years. Okay,
true enough. But in Little Dixie, things were different. In that 1968 election, Hubert Humphrey, the Democrat, won in Pittsburgh County, where McAllister is. Humphrey won in Cole, Hughes, and Latimer counties as well, all in Little Dixie. Gerald Ford took the state in 1976, but in Little Dixie, Jimmy Carter won by a landslide. In 1980, Reagan got trounced in southeast Oklahoma. Hughes, Cole, and Haskell counties went for Walter Mondale in 1984, when Reagan won 49 of 50 states. Imagine this. Michael Dukakis beats George H.W. Bush in 1988 in Little Dixie. And of course, Southeast Oklahoma voted for Bill Clinton both times. In 2004, Thomas Frank wrote a book called What's the Matter with Kansas, in which he details the shift in Kansas, and particularly in Overland Park, from radically liberal to solidly Republican in the second half of the 20th century. He talks about the backlash against the Democratic Party over civil rights, and the successful efforts of Republicans to alter the way people vote and the issues they vote on. The point being that when rural people vote on issues like gun control, gay marriage, and abortion, Republicans win. It worked in Kansas, but clearly not in Little Dixie. In Southeast Oklahoma, Democratic dominance survives the civil rights backlash. It survives the Reagan Revolution. It survives the culture wars of the late 1980s and early 90s. But why? That's the second question this program asks. Why did Little Dixie stay so Democratic after the rest of the South went Republican? The answer is actually very simple. Great leadership. Resentment over the Civil War, coal mining, unions, European immigration, Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, these factors made Little Dixie so loyal to the Democratic Party in the first place, so that by the end of World War II, the stage was set for the rise of a handful of political leaders that would transcend the national forces working against the Democratic Party.
In that culture, by the time of the 1950s and 60s, with J. Howard Edmondson, a Muskogee family, George Nye, a McAllister family, Gene Stipe, a McAllister family, with E.T. Dunlap reorganizing higher education in the 40s and 50s, comes out of southeastern Oklahoma, the old Choctaw Nation. This is the culture that is shaping state government in the 40s and 50s, and it's solidly Democratic.
Perhaps chief among all of the influential political leaders from southeast Oklahoma was Robert S. Kerr, first a successful oil man, then governor of Oklahoma, then Democratic senator from Oklahoma. He went from Ada to one of the most powerful people in the country. Just listen to how he was introduced on this CBS program.
Join us now for a Washington conversation with one of the most powerful men in the Congress today, and probably the wealthiest, Senator Robert S. Kerr, Democrat of Oklahoma. The CBS television network presents Washington Conversation, an attempt to sketch in some of the details of this man, Robert S. Kerr. In many ways, Robert S. Kerr is unique. He has accomplished what he set out to do. Early in life, he set three goals: to have a family, be a millionaire, and to become governor of his state of Oklahoma. And he accomplished all three. In 1952, he tried for the Democratic presidential nomination and failed, saying, "It would appear that the people did not realize what a superior product was being offered them."
Bob Kerr saw the importance of infrastructure. Oklahoma has more lakes than any other state in the country. That's true, and none of them are natural. All of them are man-made. And Bob Kerr is one of the main reasons they're there. He helped send man to the moon and transformed the geography of Oklahoma with the sheer force of his political will. He pushed for and got the massively expensive Kerr-McClellan navigation system put in place. It's the furthest inland deepwater port in North America and connects Oklahoma to the Gulf of Mexico. Keith Gaddy.
It was cheaper to send a man to the moon than to send a ship to Catoosa. Okay?
Right.
Okay. But Kerr was a hell of a guy. V.O. Key talks about these politicians. They call them the hell of a guy hypothesis, which is that there are these guys who loom large just by virtue of big personality. Bob Kerr was one of these. Huey Long was another. David Boren's one of them. These men who can just step forward, and they're always men, who can just dominate a room, and their personality just takes it over. You know, hail fellow well met. Hail fellow well met.
With Bob Kerr in power, it's like the New Deal never ended in Little Dixie. Here's Kerr in 1962, just before his death, and listen to him work a crowd.
You know, when I ran for Governor Stewart in 1942, I naturally thought the oil men would be for me. I'd been one for 18 years. And two or three of them were. You know, I hadn't been running very long until they found out I was a New Dealer, Governor. And that hurt me. Hurt me bad. And then the New Dealers found out I was an oil man. And that damn near beat me.
Former Governor George Nye also hails from Little Dixie. He's nearly 90 years old, though you wouldn't know it by how he bounces around this diner in Edmond where I finally tracked him down. He remembers working for Bob Kerr when he was growing up in McAllister in the 1940s and in the 50s when Kerr ran for president. He knew Kerr intimately. I asked Nye what he was like.
What was he like?
Oh, he was wonderful. Oh, he was wonderful. You'd love to be with him.
Yeah.
You would love to be with him. In 1950, as a senior in college, I run for the legislature, and Kerr comes to McAllister to a political rally, and I go up to him, this big, tall guy, and I said, "Senator Kerr, I'm George Nye." He hit my hand, pushed it away, put his arm around me, and he said, "Oh, George, I know who you are." But he told me something I've never forgotten. He said, "But I predict you will go far if you'll remember three things." I said, "Yes, sir, what are those?" Now, here I am, a candidate, a senior in college, and he said, "You'll go far if you remember three things. Always give your name when you see somebody. Give your name first so he can act like he knows you." That's the first thing. Second, read the newspaper. This is before television. Read the newspaper every day so that wherever you go that day, you'll know what they're talking about. And three, never pass up a men's room.
Robert S. Kerr was known as the King of the Senate, but standing equally tall, even though he was much shorter, was Carl Albert, the Little Giant. When I asked Governor Nye why the Democratic Party dominated Little Dixie in the second half of the 20th century, his answer is Bob Kerr and Carl Albert.
Carl Albert was a congressman from McAllister. He was a brilliant man. He was from Bug Tussle, Oklahoma. Went to a two-room schoolhouse for 8 years. Two-room schoolhouse for 8 years. Then transferred to McAllister High School. Became a national high school debate champion from McAllister, Oklahoma. Went to OU. Became a Rhodes Scholar. Went to England for his Rhodes Scholarship. Went into the Army as a private. Came out as a colonel. He was brilliant. He was a leader. And he ran and got elected to Congress from southeastern Oklahoma.
There, Albert would make all the right friends and take his place among the most powerful people in the country.
In those days, strangely enough, Texas and Oklahoma pretty much ran Congress. Lyndon Johnson in the United States Senate, Vice President and President. Robert S. Kerr from Ada, Oklahoma, was the most powerful man. According to Life magazine, Robert S. Kerr of Ada, Oklahoma, was the most powerful man in the United States Senate. Kerr and Lyndon Johnson, who was the head of U.S. Senate, were the two best friends. Carl Albert was a majority leader in the United States Congress. The congressman from Texas across the Red River that adjoined Carl Albert's congressional district was Sam Rayburn, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. Two leaders in the United States Congress were from Texas, a congressman and a senator. Their best friends were Bob Kerr from Oklahoma and Carl Albert. And Sam Rayburn picked Carl Albert to follow him as speaker. So this guy that went to a two-room schoolhouse at Bug Tussle was the most powerful man in the United States Congress. This guy from Ada, Oklahoma, was the most powerful man in the United States Senate.
When Little Dixie had a voice that big, there wasn't much of a reason to vote Republican.
And so when Albert would run for re-election, what he had done for our district as a congressman and the power that he had, people would just kind of overlook some things and say, "Well, we need to keep him."
Even after he retired, Albert retained his long political reach, like in this ad during Democrat David Walter's successful unseating of incumbent Republican Harry Bellman in 1990.
Mr. Speaker, Carl Albert, the little giant from Little Dixie, is strongly endorsing David Walters for governor.
This generation belongs to this generation. This generation, if it's going to get anywhere, must be led by leaders of this generation. I know of no man who represents the new generation in Oklahoma as well as David Walters. He's got all of the qualifications necessary to make him a great governor and a great leader in our state. I've known Henry Bellman a long time because Henry and I belong to the same generation. I've retired and I thought Henry had. I think he should.
This brings us to the third leg in the stool that would support Democratic dominance in southeast Oklahoma through the 1990s. Carl Albert and Robert S. Kerr were national leaders, but Gene Stipe made Little Dixie his kingdom in state politics. He represented McAllister in the state Senate for 46 years, from 1957 until 2003. In that time, he became a legendary man of the people who'd help his constituents any way he could, as long as there was something in it for him. And it's time for complete truth between us, listener. I myself benefited from Gene Stipe's far-reaching influence. My family, the Layden family, was very close to Stipe. I have in my hand a copy of Gene Stipe's autobiography, A Gathering of Heroes, and on the first page, it's signed, "To My Best Friend Bill Layden, My Granddad." When I was in high school, I told my granddad I'd like to work at the local radio station, KNED, in McAllister. Well, Gene Stipe owned all four McAllister radio stations. Grandpa Bill called Gene, and Gene called the station manager, and wouldn't you know it, I got a job at the radio station. And that's how Stipe worked. McAllister attorney Eddie Harper was Stipe's law partner for decades and talks about how every Saturday, Stipe would hold court at his law office. People would line up to ask for help from Uncle Gene.
Well, he worked hard, and he cared about people. And he'd meet with people all the time and try to help them with whatever their problem was. He might not be able to help them, but he'd encourage them. And they liked that, and everybody believed in him. And in our law practice, he'd come to our office on Saturday morning after he'd been in the legislature all week and see people until he had seen them all. He'd be started at 8 o'clock and wind up about 2 p.m. normally, sometimes later than that, but he'd see everybody that came that wanted to see him.
My uncle, Bill Layden Jr., practiced out of the same law office as Stipe, Harper, and my granddad.
You know, a lot of weekends he'd just drive around the county on not 69, the back roads, you know, the dirt roads, stop and talk to people. And I never know anybody that could remember somebody like him. Yeah. I mean, I never had that quality. I can't remember some of the clients I have. You know, I see them, I say, oh, that's a... but he knew names. I mean, he wouldn't just come and say, hi, you know, thanks for doing this or whatever. He remembered, but how's your wife so-and-so and your two kids? It just huge memory.
Ed Apple was a Republican state representative from Duncan in the late 1980s, at a time when Gene Stipe was known as the Dean of the State Senate. Being in separate chambers of the legislature, Apple didn't have many run-ins with Stipe, but remembers some of the ways he wielded power as head of the Senate Transportation Committee.
I was on the Transportation Committee, and we needed some industrial roads and some things made, but no roads in Oklahoma got built during that time unless they went through the committee chairman of the Senate, and that was Gene Stipe. If he didn't like the bill, he didn't hear it. And it was another, just as a, give you a little stop insight, there was a particular bill that I was co-authoring with a Republican and a Democrat in the House. And it was a pretty good bill. And I got it, what I call a co-author in the Senate. And so I get my local senator to be the co-author, so, you know, a little bipartisanship here. Sure. And he agrees. And so as it comes over to the Senate, our state senator comes up and says, hey, boy, what a deal. Gene Stipe says he'll just take over that bill and he'll be the author of it. Never heard the bill in committee. Well, all that to say is there were just certain protocols, unwritten, unspecified, but understood.
He used his influence in the Transportation Committee to bring projects to his district. McAllister has two clover leaves, one of which just happens to be right next to a convenience store Stipe used to own. He cared about his constituents, but he was far from selfless, and he had lots of enemies and scandals. The feds came after him for tax evasion. There was a dust-up about ghost employees at the State Health Department office building in Pittsburgh County and improper campaign contributions. He was no friend to the news media either, and felt the bad press he got in the Oklahoman newspaper was part of a personal vendetta against him. When he got frustrated with negative coverage of him in the local McAllister News Capital, Stipe started his own paper, the McAllister Democrat, and as a testament to his political power, successfully merged his paper with the News Capital, which created the McAllister News Capital and Democrat, Remember, he owned all four McAllister radio stations as well. OETA's Dick Pryor summed up Stipe's career when Stipe died in 2012.
Stipe grew up in poverty and was a longtime champion for the poor. He was also an advocate for education, corrections, highways, workers' rights, and mental health treatment.
Why do we need to protect it? The Constitution protects it.
Stipe was a successful trial lawyer, a dominant figure at the Capitol, and in and around Pittsburgh County. Voters there elected him 15 times.
I've had a great romance with the people of this district.
But there were other, more negative perceptions of Gene Stipe. Catherine Jensen White is a former journalism professor at the University of Oklahoma and author of the book Redneckin', a hell-raisin', foot-stomping guide to dancing, dipping, and doing around in a genuine country way. The book's informed by her unique point of view on Little Dixie as someone who was born there but spent her formative years in Los Angeles and Boston before returning in the late 1970s.
It was so weird for me. I was like, I stepped into some sociological swirl.
She remembers, like I do, when all these good old boys would gather in a smoke-filled room at the Macoma Lodge and play Liar's Poker, an ironically named game involving the frequency of numerals in the serial numbers of $1 bills.
But they had a room, and they went, and my dad collected dollar bills because that was what was going to happen, the Liar's Poker game.
I know exactly what you're talking about. My grandpa, Bill Layton, he would play these live poker games.
Oh, my God, Bill Layton is your grandpa. Yeah. I didn't even figure that out. That's hysterical.
Yeah, and so they'd play Liar's Poker, and I would always, when I was a kid, I would get into, you know, I'd ride around in his car, and you look in the glove compartment, and there was always this big old roll of dollar bills.
My dad read serial numbers on those dollar bills like he'd read the Bible.
Catherine Jensen White calls Stipe out on his man of the people persona.
He was the man of the people, even though that was total bull. He had so much money, and he was taking the land of the people. Well, actually, he didn't care so much about the land. He cared about the mineral rights. He would take title to those mineral rights as he defended drug case after drug case after drug case down there. So even though he was always, let's call Gene to get the new gravel road out to the barn. Let's call Gene to get Junior a job. Let's call Gene to do whatever needed to be done. He was always making so much down there.
Still, she can't deny how he endeared himself to his constituents after seeing him speak at a Savannah High School graduation ceremony.
He was standing down there and, you know, here's this guy. He's got those little half moon glasses on, rumpled, you know, cheap suit. He never dressed. He dressed just like his constituents. He never fancied up that I ever saw in the few times I saw him. And he's standing behind this lectern thing with these notes, and he was shifting back and forth, you know, like this, and he was reading, and it wasn't very inspirational. It was kind of like, y'all ought to do good.
Yeah.
Be nice to your mama. You know, don't lie, don't steal. And of course, I looked around because I'm the outlier, you know, and I'm looking around and people were on the edge of their seats.
And then in 2003, it was over. Here's the end of that report OETA did when Stipe died.
Stipe was indicted a handful of times, but beat the government on every one until he pleaded guilty to federal campaign violations in 2003. He resigned from the Senate on March 11th of that year.
It's no coincidence that it was around the same time that the Democrats finally lost their grip on Little Dixie. You'll remember from earlier in the hour when OU political science chair Keith Gaddy said Oklahoma had been a Republican state for president since the late 1960s. Well, Little Dixie didn't turn red for president consistently until it went for George W. Bush in 2000. Likewise, support for Democrats on a statewide level eroded in the rest of the state before it did in Little Dixie. Gaddy lays it out better than anyone else I talked to, and it started when Democratic U.S. Senator David Boren retired.
And David Boren's retirement leaves this huge space that the Republicans step into. So David Boren decides to retire in 1994. Okay. And Inhofe beats McCurdy. At the same time, Mike Sinar gets beat for renomination in his primary in the 2nd Congressional District. Tom Coburn beats the Democratic nominee and takes that seat. Okay. J.C. Watts wins McCurdy's seat for Congress. Right. There's a special election that spring for the 6th Congressional District won by Frank Lucas.
Gaddy says going into 1994, Oklahoma Democrats held the governorship, over 75% of the seats in both state legislative chambers, 4 of 6 congressional seats, and 1 of 2 U.S. Senate seats. In that election, Republicans get the governorship, a third of the seats in the state House, they take half of the statewide constitutional offices, they take 5 of 6 congressional seats and both U.S. Senate seats.
1994 is the big breakthrough year.
Yeah.
And it's because it's the year that Republicans discovered how to fully speak to evangelicals.
Little Dixie had always been very socially conservative, but having highly influential national, state, and local leaders trumped those leanings until the turn of the 21st century.
So this top-down realignment's underway, chipping away, chipping away, chipping away. Well, once 04 comes, Republicans have got control of one chamber of the state legislature. Then in 06, they have a tie in the Senate. Brad Hendry's reelected governor. Then in 08, they get the Senate, right? Mm-hmm. Then in 10, Mary Fallon gets elected governor, and they've got two-thirds majorities in both chambers. And the bottom drops out. Then in 12, they start winning Little Dixie seats, right? I mean, they take Kenneth Corn's Senate seat in 2010, right?
Gene Stipe resigned in 2003 over illegal campaign contributions to Walt Roberts' congressional campaign, but he was about to be gone anyway. 12-year term limits went into effect in 1992, about the time a new group of young Little Dixie Democrats was needed. It was an effort fueled in part by a desire not to see lawmakers become as powerful as Stipe did. And when it came to Poto State Senator Kenneth Corn, the strategy hit its mark.
If Kenneth Corn wasn't term limited, he'd still be in the Senate, and he'd be a non-corrupt version of Gene Stipe. He was the next one. Term limits caused a lot of really high-quality Democrats to have to exit politics.
Corn tried to run for lieutenant governor, but failed. He experienced the Democrats' loss of Little Dixie firsthand. He couldn't get rid of the public service bug, though. I caught up with him in Anadarko, southwest of Oklahoma City, where he's now the city manager.
I came from the school of public service, that kind of like Jim Hamilton, Carl Albert, and Robert S. Kerr, and Gene Stipe, and others who believed that our job was there for the people, and we responded to them. We weren't just people voting on laws and determining how tax money was being spent. We were really directly their employee, and we did things outside the scope of just what people today think a lawmaker should do. We were really more social workers as well as policymakers.
The first reason he gives for Democrats finally losing dominance in southeast Oklahoma is that the political machine these great leaders built there ended with Gene Stipe's political career, and term limits kept their successors from taking a political hold on the area.
Because what happens is when someone stays there for such a long time, they become kind of the institution, and each generation of voter comes behind them are used to voting for that name. And then when the seat comes open, there was really not a farm team, so to speak, for the Democrats, because we had the same people on the ballot year after year after year, and we weren't grooming people because we always had our candidates.
Right.
And what ended up happening was the Republican Party had done a fairly good job of starting putting people on school boards and city councils that were nonpartisan. And then when those things came open, they had people prepared to run for them that people had already voted for in other fashion. And we'd basically quit doing that in Oklahoma. But we lost big personalities that people respected, but even their endorsement didn't carry it over to the guy they were trying to help.
That's one reason Democrats finally lost Little Dixie. Unfortunately, another reason is the election of a black president. I wish it wasn't so, but at least from the perspective of those who knew Little Dixie, it appears to be true.
I think what happened to Democrats in Oklahoma, we've always been conservative. the Democrats here are conservative to moderate. They're nothing like a Democrat on the national scale. And we were able to continue on because people recognized that.
With the election of Barack Obama as president, that split between Oklahoma Democrats and Washington Democrats became a chasm and a reminder of Little Dixie's post-Civil War roots.
Well, I'll just tell you, when I ran for lieutenant governor in 2010, that's a better. No matter where I went, I would have people say, I can't vote for a Democrat as long as he's the president. I had people say, I heard more people use the N-word than I'd ever heard ever. And people I respected that were business leaders and church leaders in the community, and I found that very odd. And then for those of us who happen to share the same party, we don't always agree with the president, and there are a lot of things I've been disappointed that he has done or hasn't done. And I would say he's definitely not been one of the best presidents we've had. But the rest of us that happen to be in the same party, whether we agreed with him or not, have been punished for things he's done or not done, or people's general dislike of him.
We had a Republican primary? Oh, my God. That's crazy.
That's Brenda Callahan. She's vice chair of the Democratic Party in the 2nd Congressional District, Eastern Oklahoma. That's the seat Democrat Dan Boren used to hold, but now belongs to Republican Mark Wayne Mullen.
There's definitely a trend going on. It's just mind-boggling to me. In southeastern Oklahoma, where Democrats were so prominent, and we had great, great congressional Senate leaders, for us to be trending toward Republican, it just blows my mind. I mean, we are very poor here in southeastern Oklahoma, and it's almost like people are just cutting off their nose despite their face. I have no idea.
Callahan also sees the loss of influential leadership as the main reason Little Dixie finally turned away from the Democrats. But she too points out the role racism and the election of Barack Obama played, especially for older voters. And in Pittsburgh County, the oldest voters are the most Democratic.
Absolutely racist part of it. And of course, but they're not going to tell you, oh, they're not racist. Oh, yeah, right? Okay.
She pulls out a big pile of voting records. She's going through records of consistent Democratic voters in the McAllister area and sending mailers to the youngest of them. Callahan reads the ages of each voter.
But look here, in this precinct, look here, 82-71.
Wow.
These are our regular voters, 88. Okay, 73, 84, 81. Here's one at 57 I sent a letter to.
What's left of the Democratic Party in Pittsburgh County is dying, and the ones that are still around generally hate President Obama.
83, 82, 82, 73, 71. Here's one at 59 I sent a letter to. 79, 79, 88. These are our consistent voters. 91, 88, 75.
The issue of race comes up again when I go to Wilburton and talk to Latimer County Democratic Party organizers Les and Ruth Brelsford.
When the president got elected, President Obama, then it was a lot more race-related hatred than anybody ever wanted to say. You know,
no one will call it, and it is. It was racism. Now the 8-6 years. Enough things have happened that they have specific antipathy to him and to his policies. Yeah. So you have executive privilege and different things that have happened. So there's specific things, and
so
no one even
started with race, and now there's these other things.
Yeah, I feel that very strongly, that it was just too much for Southern Democrats to accept an African-American having that much authority.
But there seems to be a third factor at work. In 2006, researchers Stefano Della Vigna and Ethan Kaplan published a working paper called The Fox News Effect, Media Bias and Voting. It found that in the 2000 presidential election, the presence of the Fox News channel, which gives a conservative slant on the news, in a town's cable lineup, equated to about a half a percentage point bump in Republican gains compared to the 1996 election. Maybe it's not a coincidence that Fox News premiered around 1998 in towns across Little Dixie, right when this trend toward the Republican Party took off. The Brelfords certainly don't think so.
See, there wasn't even cable down here.
Right, before,
you know?
Right,
there, even if, it, so yeah, right. That, everybody was getting 2, 6, and 8.
Right.
They were still getting ABC, NBC, CBS, and having pretty even-handed coverage of the Vietnam War and even the first Iraqi War, pretty even-handed coverage of everything. And now it's in every doctor's office.
Yes. Yeah.
If you go to the doctor in Fort Smith, which is where, of course, we have to doctor down here, or McAllister, and Fox is what's going to be on the monitor, the TV in the waiting room is going to be Fox.
Former POTO lawmaker Kenneth Corn, the next Gene Stipe if it weren't for term limits, also mentions the rise of the Fox News Channel, a change in the way people in the area get their news, as playing a part in withering support for Democrats in southeast Oklahoma.
And now they get it from Fox News, yeah. And I'll tell you, if Fox is probably the most untrusted news source there is. They're not very reliable in what they report. And it's an opinionated and more of an entertainment type of news source than the others. 24-hour news media has changed greatly how people interact with their government. In fact, they have so sensationalized things that policymakers can't actually work towards compromise in order to get things done and solve problems because everything has become so philosophical, driven by the 24-hour news cycle.
The loss of great Democratic Party leaders and the death of the old Democratic political machine, term limits, racism, and the election of President Obama, the rise of conservative media on television— all of these different factors converged on southeast Oklahoma at the turn of the 21st century, and relatively quickly wiped out the progressive dominance that took a century to put in place and the likes of Carl Albert, Robert S. Kerr, and Gene Stipe to maintain. It's a fascinating story I could never do full justice to, but what I've tried to do is convey the political history and changes in southeast Oklahoma from the perspective of those who are and were a part of that history. Every Democratic Party activist I talked to said there would come a day when Little Dixie would be solidly Democratic again. And Democrats do still hold a 3-to-1 voter registration advantage in Pittsburgh County, for example. But those Democrats are voting for members of the other party, like Larry Boggs, a Republican, who now sits in Gene Stipe's old state Senate seat.
Two wheels are turning, one girl a yearning. Big motor burning the road. I'll ride the highway. I'm going my way. I leave a story untold. Pretty girls behind me, but pretty girls are everywhere. Big motor.